The business of culture, the culture of business, markets, policy, media, and technology, creatives, we're like a combination KFC, Pizza Hut, Taco Bell, only healthier. Full disclosure, I'm Robin Farzad.
The message that we keep hearing over and over again is, you have made me feel like I'm not alone. Or, oh my God, thank you so much. Like, you know, the thing that we didn't realize is that how people connect to these memes at a very deep emotional level. There is something so powerful in people just saying, listen, I want to feel connected and validated that the things that I'm feeling right now are in fact insane. And yes, they are.
In case you missed it, back at you with another Full Disclosure Rewind, featuring highlights from recent episodes. You'll hear about a journey away from the white evangelical church, the grit and risk-taking it takes to run a major ad agency in 2024, and the art of lampooning corporate America on social media. Stick around. Full Disclosure Podcast to NPR, Spotify, and of course, Apple Podcasts. The link is fulldradio.com. You can follow on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn at handle fulldradio. And a shout out to our listeners on WVTF Radio IQ, Virginia's NPR news station. You can DM me to carry Full Disclosure on your air. Welcome to Full Disclosure Rewind. We start with NPR's Sarah McCammon, who joined us live in downtown Richmond to discuss her bestseller, The Ex-Vangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. I have to fast forward you in the book to January 6th. I mean, I was recording a podcast with someone from the Wall Street Journal while that was happening. And I remember as the photos came, as I was reading this book, I thought about, you know, especially ended up who you married and the discussion of Judaism and the mezuzah and everything. There's actually a tableau, if you look at it, of a guy from Delaware, he's since been arrested, coming in, storming, I think, into the Senate with a Confederate flag. And sitting next to him is an Orthodox Jew from Brooklyn with a police barricade wearing a pelt. Never the twain shall really meet. And if you look at the side photo next to them, there was somebody positioned outside to storm that area to come in that had a T-shirt on that said Camp Auschwitz. If there ever was a metaphor for the unusual coalition of people who bought into, and you mentioned this in another interview, Kellyanne Conway's fateful words, alternative facts. I mean, the leaps of faith of things that you can believe. I hate using the verb weaponize, but when you are given that ability to say, no, I don't have to believe that the world is round, or I don't have to believe that this happened, I don't have to believe the election results, that it's actually quite dangerous, blind faith.
Well, you mentioned January 6th, and that event and those images, particularly the Christian images, were part of the reason I decided to write this book. I had been thinking for a long time about the really strange and kind of unexpected intersection of my personal backstory and my professional life. You know, once again, I found myself covering all of these issues and concerns and players that had been so central in my childhood as I was covering the 2016 campaign. But I wasn't sure what I wanted to say. I didn't want to write a pure memoir, and I didn't want to write a campaign book because there are a lot of those. But I would be asked all the time, you know, by people who knew how I'd grown up. Well, what do you see here? How do you make sense of this? How do you explain it? And I was not at the Capitol on January 6th. I was covering the Georgia Senate runoff. But actually, I was at a Trump rally just before, I think it was January 4th or 5th, because, you know, Georgia was having that pivotal Senate election that same week, right? There were the two Senate seats at stake.
Yeah.
And so Trump did a rally in support of the Republican candidates. And I remember talking to people, and I have some tape of this that went on Here and Now the next day, you know, talking to people who were talking about how they were going to go to the Capitol, and they were going to, you know, it wasn't clear what they were going to do, but they were talking about being willing to fight. And I didn't know what was coming, but the next day it became really clear as I, you know, I was driving across the state of Georgia, listening to our live special coverage of the attack. And then to see those images, you know, of crosses and signs that said Jesus saves. I think for anybody with a Christian background and who takes those images seriously and to whom they mean something, I think for many of us, it was kind of stunning. Although not entirely surprising, given the increasing rhetoric around Christian nationalism that we were seeing then and certainly are seeing now. To your point about alternative facts, you know, this is something I talk about in the book as well, just the sense that for me growing up, there were alternative facts that we sort of, including our views of science, you know, that we sort of accepted as reality. And often if facts intruded that contradicted the narrative, they were rejected. This is why There were entire textbooks and just an entire infrastructure of knowledge and information that was set up to sort of protect this
in parallel,
worldview.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I was also struck in the ensuing dragnet after January 6th with the Justice Department. You've covered this. The crowdfunding apparatus invokes Christianity a lot. If you notice, like, Christian fundraising for the hostages, the political prisoners of January 6th, I mean, it continues. Even after the violence, even after some people attacked Capitol police officers or were at the very least, you know, uncivil and unchristian, Christianity was yet invoked to raise money for their defense.
Yeah, and that's nothing new. I think that Republican politicians in particular, and some on the left as well, have been invoking religion for many years. And, you know, I think there's an interesting debate to be had about how much we should talk about religion in politics. I mean, there are efforts on the religious left to say, to push back against the Republican narrative and to say, no, you know, Christianity is really about feeding the poor and helping the stranger and loving your neighbor. And, you know, I'm a journalist, so I am not going to comment on what strategy is right or what philosophy is right, but I think it's an interesting debate. Like should anybody be making those arguments? I can understand strategically why the left would want to push back on the idea that Christianity is this one thing that the right tries to perpetuate. But it's not new, but it is a message we've heard from Trump a lot, this idea that, once again, there's like this existential threat that the country is in danger, that he can save it, and that he is going to protect Christians is a promise that he's made more than once, and that many of his supporters seem to accept.
I sometimes come in on tangent on this show because I like to open up kind of the thought bubbles or the parenthetical asides when I'm reading a book like this. I was like, in that you cover politics intimately and you host the NPR Politics podcast, do you ever just want to wonk out and go back and look at the electoral results of 1976? And yes, it was a peculiar time after Watergate.
Not really, Robin.
But
Jimmy, you do you.
Jimmy Carter, a pious guy with a peanut farm and dedicated his life and everything and won over swaths of the South. You would not recognize states that are now ruby red, that, you know, back then it wasn't as political a thing. And there was the declension of the Democratic Party over decades. But now they fairly, you know, you talk about the analysis in this and the people in exit polls who, you know, vote in the primaries for Trump. It's exceedingly kind of red state and evangelical cleave together.
Yeah, and I think, you know, historians like Randall Balmer have written quite a bit about this and about the transition that took place around that time, when, you know, the sort of shift from Carter to Reagan and the mobilization of the religious right. What my book is really about is what it's like to grow up inside that world that was being created then. And, you know, what that felt like, what that looked like, the information sort of sphere that surrounded us. And then, you know, as I've said, the reality that for many people who've come of age in a time where information is readily accessible, where we have an increasingly diverse society, where, you know, if you're told that the Earth is 6,000 years old, it's very easy to go online and kind of see that most people with knowledge about these things would say otherwise. And also, you know, I think there's just more understanding about, you know, the fact that not everybody is a cis straight person. You know, if you look at data around even younger evangelicals are much more accepting of same-sex marriage than their older counterparts. And so the culture has shifted a lot in recent decades. And I think it's a fascinating sort of set of cross currents that we're seeing, you know, at the moment that the country is becoming less religious, you know, far less religious than it once was, and much less dominated by white Christianity. We see sort of this zenith, or we saw at least in 2016, of Christian right political power. And observers and scholars like Robbie Jones of the Public Religion Research Institute would argue that those two trends are not, it may seem like a juxtaposition, you know, how strange that white evangelicalism is shrinking and yet more powerful than ever, but that's not an accident. In many ways, Jones and others have argued that the rise of Trumpism is a reaction to the sense of losing cultural power. Mm.
And then as you see some people even in this demographic decline in terms of clout, and you document in this, what do you call them, the nones? The people who are non-affiliated or don't go
the
to
nuns,
church?
Yeah. The nuns, yeah, N-O-N-E-S.
So, it's interesting, it's striking in that during this period, there are those on the right who are really doubling down. No, let's smash the taboo. It should be a Christian fundamentalist country. We should restore these values. We should be cautious about the books we have in the public school system or the various things going on in the Deep South. I mean, there's this, it is a paradox in that you have the Supreme Court, you got the ultimate prize in the reversal of Roe v. Wade, which you covered so well for several years. What's left at this point?
Well, I think we're seeing some of it play out with debates around things like IVF.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that the controversy in Alabama recently was a really fascinating window into where things could go next, because for many years, opponents of abortion rights, some of them have said that life begins at conception. That is a moral and frankly often religious point of view. And if one takes that literally, then that has implications for all sorts of medical care, including in vitro fertilization, fertility treatments, as well as potentially some forms of birth control. And so we saw the Alabama Supreme Court say essentially, yes, embryos should be treated like children. And then we saw Republicans very quickly, you know, rush to say, no, that's not what we want to do. That's not the policy that we're going to carry forward. The challenge is, and certainly there's a spectrum within the GOP and within abortion, people who generally oppose abortion, you know, some support just certain restrictions and some support full restrictions. But that sort of underlying philosophy that would say any embryo, any conception is a life, is a person, and has the same rights as anyone else. I mean, that has implications, almost certainly will have implications for other types of care beyond just abortion. And so it's been, I think, fascinating to watch that debate play out, to see the Republican messaging around it. And what I'm curious about is kind of where that goes next. Will the faction of the anti-abortion rights movement that believes in that deeply double down on that policy and on that idea and the policies that would result from it? Or will sort of the more, more moderate Republicans, I suppose, win out in at least in terms of passing some of these protections for things like IVF? You know, I don't know what happened in Alabama was obviously the legislature did pass protections, but I'm just curious where that goes next.
You know, as you describe in the book, simultaneous with this period of soul searching and reflection and rediscovering kind of your path and the great wide open, you converge with your grandpa who is ailing. And I always say that a lot of your 30s and even your 40s in my case, maybe this is being indulgent, is unlearning kind of the stuff that was spoon-fed to you in the early decades when you really didn't have a chance. I mean, maybe this is my own psych therapy pro bono to you, but I mean, your grandpa was a huge part of that. And it's not like he could interfere in reverse and kind of stage an intervention for you, that everybody was all hands. We got to pray for grandpa and everything. But you as an adult converged with him where he was and he met you where you were. Talk about that.
Well, as I've mentioned, he was one of the few people I knew growing up who didn't share our religious faith. And we were very concerned about that. And, you know, I tell a story in the book about kind of how I found out that he was gay. It was something that was sort of hidden from me for a long time. And he was sort of kept from me for the most part for many years. We were allowed to see each other, but only on certain occasions. And, you know, I came to find out that there were a lot of rules around that. And we just didn't have a close relationship because of those restrictions. And because my parents, frankly, were concerned that he would be a bad influence on us because of his sexuality. And that was something I had to contend with growing up. I wasn't sure what I thought. You know, I was hearing only one perspective on that for many years. But, I'm very grateful that he lived a very long life. And we did have many years together as an adult. And I was able to sit down with him a couple of times and ask for his thoughts on life and even spirituality. And, you know, it was fascinating to discover that really his view of the world was much more complex than what I'd been told. You know, he had thought deeply about some of these issues, but had just come to different conclusions.
For a searcher, for someone who's trying to synthesize these thoughts, and you explain in the book how you're troubled with it. Some nights you wake up in a sweat. Sometimes you're in a moment of peace. Sometimes you're in a moment of panic or doubt, or did I go the wrong way? You discussed this earlier, the era of social media and the internet, and anybody can Substack or WordPress or share these things. There's unbelievable amounts of candor out there. I mean, slicing and dicing. These people would have had to vie to get some time on NPR 20, 25 years ago. Now there are specific podcasts about this. There are podcasts about, you know, there have been Netflix series about leaving the Orthodox Jewish community. There's an unbelievable system of outreach out there. Again, the hashtag itself, for you to even find people, research, reporting in this thing, it's very different than kind of, you know, making sure your parents aren't watching and going into some musky library and looking for old tomes.
Yeah. I sometimes talk about the fact that when I was growing up, people who left their churches were labeled as backsliding. And, you know, it could be very lonely. And I think this is true of any religious community, any sort of strict or high control, is I think the term that sociologists use, religious community where the boundaries are very carefully policed and there's not a lot of room for dissent. And, you know, I think one of the things that I found when I started paying attention to these social media spaces after I heard this term ex-evangelical was that for many people, this was a space where they could find that community around these ideas and have someone else to talk to about, you know, it's really a difficult and complicated process to try to rethink your whole belief system. And so, you know, we're seeing this term deconstruction. I'm seeing it in you know, ex-Mormon communities, ex-evangelical, and so forth. It's not restricted to evangelicals, but that is sort of the main space that I pay attention to. But yeah, I think it's very different. I mean, the internet has changed, obviously, so many things, but it's made that process of leaving a religious community, I think, much easier, and people have resources at their fingertips if they're looking for support or just someone else who's sort of walking the same path.
You were listening to some of the recent live show with NPR's Sarah McCammon, who joined us to discuss her best-selling book, The Ex-Evangelicals. Catch the entire conversation at fulldradio.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Full disclosure, do stay with us. We continue with some of my recent chat with Danny Robinson, the new CEO of award-winning ad shop, The Martin Agency. He delved into the challenge of staying competitive, omnivorous, and funky amid the seemingly relentless disruption of advertising and media. This has been a year of hell for big media conglomerates. You look at Warner Brothers, Discovery, Disney, clearly Paramount, which is looking for a buyer. Paramount owns CBS, which is kind of a true north, a lot of sports assets. But, you know, brands like Nickelodeon and MTV, which used to drive the conversation, but the cable cord cutting has just unbelievable amounts of people leaving TV and becoming, especially if you talk to my kids, my younger kids, they go straight to YouTube, where it's just much harder and much more fragmented. So you might have the great ideas, but you're hustling. Like, do we have to have a TikTok strategy? Do we need to be on Instagram? Do we have to have a portfolio of influencers? Do we have to have celebrity adjacency? Suddenly table stakes is, you know, big celebrities have to have a podcast. I don't know how you put your head on a pillow at night and sleep with, you know, forgive me, with job security, thinking about all that.
Well, the answer to the question is yes, you need to have that, all of that and more. And it's obviously brand specific, but yes, the thing that allows me to sleep, I think, is that all of those things are also opportunity for us. The channels used to be really clear and small in number. TV, print, out of home, radio. That's about it.
Yeah.
Every once in a while you might do a stunt, and they were called stunts because that's what they really were. Now it is the opportunity to create, and the media and the places to put things is, it's not infinite, but it certainly is a lot broader than when I started. So an optimist might say, that's great. That means there are other ways for us to use creativity to solve business problems if we can find the audience that we need to find and talk to them in the place where they are seeking information, as opposed to interrupting the thing that they were looking at, like watching television and putting a commercial in front of them. You could say that, well, if we're in the right place on TikTok, on Instagram, and they're actually seeking us out, which is why we made Martin Entertainment, we need to be as entertaining as the content that they are seeking out on their own.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that because YouTube is a colossus. I think Google paid $2.6 billion for it.
What a bargain.
And then now it becomes, as a guest we recently had on said, it was a never-ending video jukebox out there. I mean, it knows how to feed you, and you could call it, there's no real analog to it. There's the biggest cable channel ever known to man. But I have never really wanted to watch an ad. Everybody looks for the skip, the 5-second button. And it's like we're going through the motions of doing this, and there was a great golden age of streaming where suddenly you were getting Disney Plus and others without the ad experience and getting it for a low clip, and you got used to being able to binge and watch without advertising. So also don't want to be subversive. You don't want to kind of fool people like, look, the ads are coming in here. But if they can come to something in entertainment and legitimately find curation and, I don't know, celebrity adjacency, you're accomplishing a lot under one roof.
Those streaming days of no ads are good luck looking finding that.
No, Netflix is doubling down on advertising. All of them are pushing through the ad tier.
Yeah.
And they're still losing money.
Yes. And the The opportunity again is if you're going to be advertising on Netflix, you better find a way to entertain. You better have your message be entertaining, which is, again, I think that's an opportunity. It's one of the reasons we created Martin Entertainment. We saw that coming. We hired Alana Strauss, who used to work at Netflix and then at Fender. And she knows what it takes to be a part of the Netflix family. She knows that we need to have entertainment. It is still, it's commercials again. That no one's going to be calling it that.
Right.
But it is advertising during content. Our content has to, strongly believe our content has to be as entertaining as the content that the people are seeking out. And Netflix is probably a great place to test that model out. They're not going to be happy at first, and then they'll be fine. Because
is there a place that you've seen it that was not done in this shop that you said, yes, that's it? I'll give you my example,
yes.
For example. The Daft Punk album that came out in 2013, Random Access Memories,
mm-hmm.
Sony commissioned a pre-doc of the backstories of every track on YouTube. And so Giorgio Moroder was interviewed. There was the guy who did Piano, the guys who were approached, the backstory, Panda Bear, mm-hmm. and others who were approached by these mysterious two Daft Punk robots from France.
Yes.
And before you even heard of the song, they were leaving you little crumbs. And Sony was just behind the scenes. It had the thing at the very outset. And I was already anticipating that album, but that made me feel super jazzed that I knew the kind of, even before Song Exploder or anything.
Right.
And so, yeah, Sony was there behind the scenes. It didn't need to hit me over the head with a Walkman mm-hmm. or an LCD TV or anything. And I was like, all right, this is how it's done. And that was already way back, 11 years ago.
And how many people did you tell about it?
Everybody.
Yeah.
I kept sending it around. I was like, wow. The backstory of Giorgio Moroder was one of the founding fathers of disco.
Mm-hmm.
And to be approached by these guys saying, we want to do this song. And them saying, we don't even know how this is going to end up, but you're so flattered that the guys from France would summon you over and just keep, sampling stuff and everything. And the reveal to them was just as fascinating as it was to you.
Yeah.
And I realized that I was doing Sony's marketing on behalf of them.
That's a great example. And relevant to you, because I get a sense that music is part of who you are.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you told...
Music makes me lose control. Sorry. I have to put a lyric into everything.
Let's go. That's a great example. That's an example of being relevant to you.
Yeah.
You telling everyone you know is an example of you being a micro-influencer, maybe without even thinking that you are.
I'm just a suburban dad.
Yeah, sure.
With a podcast mic. Anyway, go ahead.
But that's what I'm talking about. That's what that was selling. Wasn't selling you. It was entertaining you. A product they wanted you to eventually buy. But in a way that did not feel like either an ad or an interruption.
Like, what was the genesis of that? Was it an agency of record that went to Sony Records and said, "We want to do this"? The Daft Punk robots weren't in it. It was somebody interviewing. I'll send
still
it to you.
Still sounds like the creative minds of the Daft
Punk. Of the Daft Punk people. Yeah. And then something else happened in parallel at this very agency that was really formative for me. And I wish that we had pounced on it. One of your or two of your creatives, I don't know if it was a marijuana moment or something. They got around in a circle in 2014 and said, you know what? Foo Fighters haven't been here in 16 years, whatever it was, and then yeah. everything. And they challenged mm-hmm. Dave Grohl and mm-hmm. the Foo Fighters to come to this. You remember this story?
Yeah, oh, yeah, I was here.
This notional concert at the National, and then it happened. And the people that attended and put the money in escrow to go to this concert that didn't just exist, Dave Grohl looks yeah. at it and says, yeah, you know what? I'll do it. He lives in Northern Virginia and everything. And yep. everybody loved that night. And now it's like fabled. You hear stories about it. The people are like, if you just knew what came together that night, how intimate it was. And I wish that the world had covered that better. Mm. I wish that Richmond and Rolling Stone and everybody was there to say, this was the first true A-list on-demand concert in history
yeah.
that cut out Ticketmaster and the others.
Yeah, just some people who like Foo Fighters who wanted to see them.
Some real fans with agency that wanted to see them to see them intimately. And there was a documentary about it, but then it kind of came, had it been used to its max, maybe they would have had him on point at the end of that concert and said, all right, Dave, who do you dare to come on next? Like kind of like an ice bucket challenge. But I was thinking about that at that point. I mean, what was an incentive for a band that makes a ton of money on merch and touring and everything to come and do a 1,500 show venue in Richmond, Virginia, but they knew that that would have meant so much to fans and the multiplier effect of it. And the donut salesman guy, the guy Sugar Shack, who was just starting up, showed up with a bunch of boxes and Dave Grohl Instagrammed it. And that was in the infancy of this show. That was really eye-opening to me.
Yeah, that was the right band too. Dave Grohl was the right guy too.
How would you know?
Well, if you know them, because Kiss would not have shown up.
Yeah.
For example, I think the Foo Fighters was the right band, and Dave was the right guy to do something like that. But you're right. If and maybe this, I'm not sure this is good or bad.
Yeah.
If the same idea came up today, there would have been more attached to it because the team would have thought, okay, we'll do this and what else will be a part of it. Like you said, they would, let's have Dave ask for the next band to come. Let's do something. Let's find a brand.
There would have been more premeditation to it.
Yeah, a lot more. That was just pure love for a band and a couple of people who said, let's see if this works. Without a brand attached to it, without a client attached to it, it may be its purest form in 2014 and would have been maybe not as pure.
It can happen again today.
Yeah. So it's probably good that it happened then. A missed opportunity for something else, but it's probably really good that it happened then in the way that it happened.
So when the question I have, the difficult question always we've asked is, it must totally harsh your mellow when an executive, be it a CMO or whatever committee has replaced that CMO, talks about the ROI of a campaign. You could talk about impact. You could talk about page views. You could talk about impressions. You could bring all sorts of soft metrics. But if they say, whatever, on a $5 million buy, I've not seen incremental revenue on this. It's hard to get them to keep the faith when they have quarterly financials and the sword is hanging above them.
It really does depend on, I mean, which is why we asked, what are the KPIs for this thing?
Key performance.
Index. We need to know, or indicator. We need to know, what do you want this thing to do? If you want it to return $2 on a dollar investment, we need to think about what it is we're making. If you want awareness to be the thing, we have to think about what it is we're making. If we have metrics for UPS, for example, we know what they expect each of the pieces of work to do, including the work that they expect in a return, a financial return. But some of the metrics are more soft. Some of them are, we just want to be more relevant. We want to be considered more innovative. It does depend, and we need to know up front what it is they want the work to do, because if we just make something and we put it out into the world, and then the question is, well, where is the return on my dollar? You didn't say that that's what you wanted this thing to do. This thing was created to build brand awareness. And if you look at those metrics, it did exactly that. But the pressure is going to be increasingly on the, what am I getting in return? What is the dollar return? Budgets are shrinking and CMOs are being expected to return quarterly. And those things are happening and the pressures are coming. But that's not always the need for some brands. Some brands need different things to happen. And it isn't an either or, because sometimes it's, we need a return on a dollar here, but we also need to build relevance at the same time. So different pieces of communication do different things.
Are you a student of how things like, I mean, this goes back to Malcolm Gladwell's books and Tipping Points, how something like Stanley Cups came out of nowhere?
You don't want to.
No, my daughter badgers me about it. But these were like, you know, workaday soup, lunch pail type things. And then they became the hottest. You could not have premeditated that last year. You guys could not have gotten around in a circle or gone out for drinks and said, let's bring back Stanley, like, you know, Dickies, or these things just happen in a vacuum almost.
Yes, they do. And I have a feeling about Stanley Cups. They do. You can't manufacture things like that. We do work hard to manufacture fame or manufacture success, which we have a culture impact lab is a department we built to help. They're PR experts, they're social experts, to influencer experts, to help manufacture our work so that when it gets out into the world, there's a higher likelihood of it catching on and catching fire. Things like Stanley Cup, good for Stanley.
I don't even know what the parent company is. Is it Coleman? I don't even know.
I don't know.
I mean, it's such a small layer, but these are massively profitable. They're being hoarded. There's a Target version of it that was pink, or Starbucks. Like, I could not have premeditated that.
And the question is, 2025, is there going to be Stanley Cups? I listened to the Kristen Cavallo podcast, and you asked her about LaCroix or LaCroix at the time.
Wow, to think.
It's the same, except that that's sustained. But it's the same. Nobody would have guessed that another sparkling bubbly water was going to become that thing, because there were hundreds of sparkling bubbly waters. Those things you can't manufacture. And the next thing that's going to happen, you're not going to be able to know and manufacture or see coming. And that's one of the things that happens, usually happens really fast and often burns out really quickly. So we'll see. Well, a year from now, ask someone about Stanley Cups and let's see where it is.
Sure.
If there is such a thing.
Let me type that into my BlackBerry Pearl. Full disclosure, stay with us. Full disclosure podcast to NPR, Spotify, all the fine podcatchers, including and especially Apple Podcasts, whatever you prefer to use, Podtopia, I don't even know what they're called anymore. The link, it has every podcatcher, is fulldradio.com. Again, fulldradio.com. Please leave a review, tell your mother-in-law, call your girlfriend, whatever you need to do. We are on all the socials at handle fulldradio, and my DMs are always open. If you're just joining us, I'm in downtown Richmond in the heart of Shaco Slip with the new CEO of advertising giant, the Martin Agency, Danny Robinson. The AdWake Agency of the Year in 2020 and 2021, and Ad Age Agency of the Year in 2023. Since he stepped into the role of Chief Creative Officer previously, it says that you have a track record of pushing the industry forward through your efforts in the DEI space. I saw as a footnote, you sit on the board of, what is it, Creative Ladder? It's a nonprofit founded by Ryan Reynolds that increases the accessibility of creative careers for people of all backgrounds.
Yes.
Does that guy strike out? I mean, every week I see that he has a new IPO, a new company, you know, selling, I don't know, Mint Mobile or some finance thing. I mean, in addition to being an absolute A-lister and married to a goddess, does anything go wrong for this guy?
Not publicly. He's a smart, incredibly charming, talented guy. And it started with what he saw happening on movie sets. So they were behind the lens, and often in front of the lens, but behind the lens in particular. He didn't see people. Everyone looked the same, mostly white males, some white females. But he wondered, where are the people of color? Where are the underrepresented talent behind the camera? And he has a friend who is in the advertising business, or who was, who he talked to and realized it's the same thing going on in our industry, that there are talented people who don't get a shot, or there are talented people who do get a shot who are in the business who maybe weren't trained like the majority, or there are people in high school and college who don't even know that advertising is a potential career.
Sure.
So there are kind of three groups of people. So Creative Ladder was put together to help those groups, those people of color who have jobs already but maybe didn't come up in the way that the majority did and need training. There are people who are in college who are making career choices, or at least maybe not career choices, but picking majors, who don't know that advertising is a potential path. And then there are kids in high school who have no role models, who don't know that they know advertising. They're living on TikTok. They are part of what it is we do, but don't know that that's a potential career. So it was designed to help those three groups get smarter about the business, with the idea that we need to fill a pipeline with people who are just different than the industry looks.
And I see that before you were at the Martin Agency, I love saying, because it makes me seem so wise, at the turn of the century.
Oh God,
Robinson
seems so old.
Was co-founder of Vigilante, the cultural insights-driven creative shop behind the famous Oprah Winfrey Pontiac giveaway. You get a car, you get a car, you get a car. And the pop quiz quickly for you is, who spoofed that on SNL?
Maya Rudolph.
And hold that thought, because we're going to come back to her. Now that actually, so you talk about you get a car, you get a car. What about companies going directly, making the beeline to the celebrity influencer to get someone? We've had even kind of mom and pop type influencers who are in a niche, who have a really cute child, who somebody will give them a lot of merch and, you know, say in your Instagram reel that this made my life easy and my child loves these and he's great and he's never colicky. But then there are others where they'll go directly to a Kim Kardashian or a Travis Kelce, or Travis Kelce's wife, who's been getting all sorts of
engagements.
He's
not married, is he?
I'm sorry, the other Kelce.
Oh.
The brother, Jason Kelce?
Jason.
I lost track.
That's
okay.
And they
have a hit podcast, too.
Yes, they do.
Right?
Yes.
But both of them get all these overtures that I don't know if that's... Who is doing that behind the scenes, acting as agent between the corporation and the celebrity?
I mean, there are agencies built to do that. It is unlikely that brands are going directly to celebrities. It's more likely that they're going to agencies that are set up to, who manage those celebrities.
And what happens behind the scenes? Is there a discussion of culture? I mean, I didn't know this about Ryan Reynolds. Ryan Reynolds is a person of tremendous clout and agency. VCs can go to him.
Mm-hmm. And they do.
Yeah, they do. There are investors that actually go, who's the guy who won the an Oscar for playing a transgender person in Dallas Buyers Club? Jared Leto.
Yes, Jared Leto.
He is a tech investor. He is a tech angel investor. I mean, there's a backstory to all of this that if you knew kind of the backdoor channel to people and what enchants them, is the agency really doing that, or are there other specialists who bring brands into proximity with
primarily specialists? I mean, even when we have ideas for celebrities, we don't reach out to them. We reach out to their managers, or we reach out to agencies that handle celebrities. So I don't know what I know a lot of money talk goes on behind the scenes.
Yeah, yeah.
I know most of them. There is the expectation now that is part of the revenue stream for celebrities. It's funny that at the turn of the century, as you say, when we started Vigilante, that was still a time where it was considered selling out if a celebrity started talking brands. Celebrities that typically didn't, like musicians. I mean, you remember
some would go to Japan to do it. Yeah, there was a website called Japander.
The fragrance commercials overseas uses the A-list U.S. celebrities would never see over here.
Sure.
And I guess the money is a whole lot bigger.
Yeah.
And maybe they figure nobody's going to see that, and they'll still have
it's like offshoring.
Yes, right. They'll still have who they are here, but there'll be something somewhere else where nobody here will see them. I mean, you remember when the Who or the Stones, the Rolling Stones, used Start Me Up, or Microsoft Start Me Up for
launch of,
it was a big deal. Now, celebrities don't matter. No.
And then a few years after that, Sheridan tried to do a reboot, and they said, let's spend the night nobody cared. And now it's everywhere. I mean, Nick Drake was used. The late Nick Drake was used in a Volkswagen ad.
It doesn't
matter
anymore.
And I wonder how, I guess it doesn't.
It really doesn't. They don't. The money is, once the dam broke, and once enough people did it, it's part of the portfolio at this point. It's like, what can I sell? There's still some with integrity. I'm not saying that everyone's giving away everything, but they certainly don't question whether they should do it. I think at this point, it's who should I do it with, and how much are they going to pay?
Sometimes I think parenthetically in thought bubbles, and forgive me for this, but I'm watching these promos for the next season of Curb Your Enthusiasm, which I think is the last one. Mm-hmm. And on Insta, these guys are leaving. Larry's leaving a golf game with his pal, and they see Lori Loughlin with her Porsche, and it's got handicap plates on it. They're like, what? She's like, what? And they mentioned this, you know, this amorphous syndrome and everything. Uh-huh. You have that syndrome, right? She's like, what? It's like, I guess I do have that. And so she's clearly riffing on her own. And I guess you have to own it, kind of like Martha Stewart did.
Yes.
With her dalliance in prison and others and rehabilitation coming out. But I guess it's a send up on selling out in general. She sold out. She lost her authenticity. But maybe she's rehabilitated enough to go back onto the Hallmark channel or something.
Yeah, well, maybe not the Hallmark channel.
But I want to take it back to you. Authentic.
I've been working hard to keep it off of me, but
Danny,
come on.
But this is that we typically do it with the show now. And again, we started here 10 years ago. I mean, this is sacred ground for me because May 1st, 2014 was our first show.
Yeah.
And you had a vestigial audio recording studio. I mean, it didn't have anything like this back then. It was called Running with Scissors.
Yes.
Where did you grow up? Where did you start off? How did this happen?
I was born an hour and 45 minutes east of here. I never know which direction it is. In Hampton, Virginia, which is from here. Most people on the way to Virginia Beach in between.
You were listening to some of my recent episode with Martin Agency CEO Danny Robinson. Catch the entire conversation at fulldradio.com. Do stay with us. Full Disclosure podcast to NPR, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. All of the fine podcatchers, they are all at link fulldradio.com. Again, fulldradio.com. You can follow on social media at handle fulldradio. And a shout out to our home NPR station, Radio IQ. DM me to carry Full Disclosure on your air. If you're just joining us, welcome to Full Disclosure Rewind, featuring highlights from recent episodes. We close with my talk with Adil Van, the Labs consultant and startup CEO, founded Instagram phenom MBA-ish, where fun is poked, pain is felt, and help is dished out to so many lost and suffering corporate souls. Anyway, I want to get to one of the memes you cited, an NBA-ish, on your Instagram account, which has about 500,000 followers. I love it. You know, I consume it every day. The title is How My Boss, quote, collaborates with me. You have this circle. The boss asked me to solve a problem I understand deeply. The boss rejects my solution. Boss insists on their crappy solution. I execute the solution. It fails spectacularly. Boss pivots to my solution. It works. He takes credit. It's something we all know too well. And I'd love to ask you about this in the environment where it seems like the leverage is now with the workers. I think even in the white collar class, you saw what happened with the Goldman investment bankers during the pandemic who kind of fought back. They released the PowerPoint memo like, we want to fight for our rights. You can't keep us in for 23 hours a day. And then half of the population was like, oh, you poor investment bankers making hundreds of thousands of dollars. And others were like, no, they have rights. This is correct. And suddenly work from home, as you notice, and you guys cover this quite a bit. You have all of these execs out there saying that this is the way we work collaboratively. This is the way work happens, even though many of these very same firms have had record productivity and profitability during that period.
That's right. I mean, look, this is the bad news, okay? Workers had leverage from 2020 till 2022 and a half. The moment the economy started tanking, this is late 2022, October onwards, the crypto bust happened and the VC bust happened and SBF bust happened.
Sam Bankman-Fried.
Sam Bankman-Fried happened. Ever since then, slowly, and it's accelerated in the last quarter, the power is firmly in the hands of leadership again. It's actually not in the hands of workers anymore. And you can see that in the evidence of the forced return to office directives that are being given out, the massive layoffs that are taking place, the redundancies that are taking place because of AI. People, you know, I have a lot of conversations in DMs, people saying, look, I don't really have another option right now because the job market is tough. It's become so insane now.
Well, back up. There was a slew of tech layoffs. A bunch of the technology firms realized that they'd overextended. The largest ones in the world. There was Google, Meta, Facebook did it. Microsoft scaled back, and then they got to harvest those gains of productivity with bumper crop profits last year into the AI boom. And then they realized, all right, we don't have to be as fat as we were maybe in 21 and 22. But this has forced the loss of clout by a lot of unemployed people.
Correct. Exactly. So now when you go to the job market, it's a lot more competitive. And it's not just that the employee or the employers have realized that there's a lot of talent. So now, you know, my favorite topic comes into play. The insanity of recruiting has gone to the next level. 8 rounds, 9 rounds of interviews, people being left, you know, midway through the interviews because employers and leaders have realized that it's now a buyer's market. It's not a labor market anymore. So I just wanted to make that point that you mentioned. About collaboration, listen, my theory is very simple on this, and it's that executives don't know how to manage, how to build culture when people are not in the same office. And instead of saying, hey, we should actually adopt and we should adjust, just like they ask us to do in every other situation of ours, they've decided that no, squarely, I want people inside the office for X, Y, Z reason. And there's a famous article that came up by from Business Insider, I think a year ago, and it cited reasons why the senior leadership wanted people back inside the office. Now, there's this one lying narrative, which is completely false, it's propaganda, that it's about productivity. It's not about productivity at all. I think it's one of the weakest excuses that you can provide because the evidence that you mentioned earlier has been clear during pandemic, during work from home, record profits, and so forth. But the reasons that were cited by the leadership were insane. One leader said something like, well, I really enjoy seeing a full parking lot when I come into the office. Who cares? Or I really love seeing people, you know, at the water cooler having a conversation. Again, who cares? That has nothing to do with what you're doing. Or I love seeing people in the office having fun and, you know, walking by my office. And I'm like, but that office is always closed. It's never really open. There's nothing happening here, right? So leadership, for whatever reason, has decided I want people in the office because it allows me to give, you know, greater control. I don't know if that's just culturally, whatever the case is. But it has led to a very, you know, difficult environment for collaboration. You cited the collaboration meme. It's happening more and more. I think with work from home, it was a little bit of a different collaboration. I think that, you know, what I heard from people was that there was less micromanaging happening and there was more effective work going on. But now the people have you in the office, that circle that you just mentioned, that cycle of collaboration has become once again entrenched with, let's just do what I want to do and I'll take the credit for it.
I want to share one of the memes. I don't know if anybody could see it here. It's on a collaboration at the office on MBA-ish. It says, the headline is Return to Office Collaboration. And you have a bunch of, you know, clip art at an office pantry. I'm almost done my coffee. Anyone want to grab another one?
Exactly.
You know, did you see that recent one from Internet Brands with the CEO and the other executives coming out to a song saying, we're not asking, we're telling you to come back. And it leaked and it repelled back against them because they didn't even record it at the office. You could see that it was done as a blue screen.
My goodness.
You could see that the other executives, it looked like they were reading a hostage statement. And I'm thinking to myself, gosh, it's one thing for this to happen in a sub 4% unemployment rate, at least here in the United States. And with white collar, it must be even lower. But what if the unemployment rate was closer to 2008, 2009, when you kind of had your coming of age? Then I think a lot more fear would motivate people to go back to the office. Like, I got to covet the job that I did get.
I think you're seeing that fear already because a lot of people don't remember what happened in 2008. This is their 2008 from what they can tell. So the fear response hasn't changed. People are going back. And what you mentioned, I've seen a video, I'm not sure if it's the same one, but it's the brazenness of these conversations now. And that's why I say the, you know, power dynamic has shifted towards the leadership. And it's going to take another 18 months for it to balance out. But the brazenness of it is really disgusting to watch, you know, especially for those employees that are watching these videos. It's very clear. And, you know, in the DMs I've been hearing over the last 3 months, how the town halls have become much, much more clearer about what they're doing. First of all, you're not allowed to ask questions anonymously anymore, because that would unfortunately put leadership into a very sensitive position of having to answer difficult questions that they've never been had to answer because it's surrounded by yes men or yes women. But people are just being told, you're coming here, and if you're not, here are the consequences. And I think there's also something a little bit more nefarious, which is that people do want to shed, or leadership does want to shed some of this fat by, you know, voluntary exits, where people are like, I'm not coming in, I might as well go somewhere else. And that's happened as well. I know I have friends at Amazon and other companies.
I hate the euphemism slapped on that, is managing people out. That's like right out of office
staff
space.
Augmentation, you know,
culling the herd.
Resizing. There's like a whole, I think there's like 15, 20 different words that are being used because they're not courageous enough to come out and say, I made a mistake and we have to let people go. It's like their family that we're now, you know, getting away from. It's a limb of ours that we have to sacrifice. No, it's not. Just keep it simple.
Full disclosure, do stay with us. Full Disclosure podcast to NPR, Spotify, all the podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts. The link, everything's all there, is fulldradio.com. Again, fulldradio.com. We are on all the socials. I'm talking Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, Friendster, Napster, Huckster, you name it. The handle is fulldradio and my DMs are open. And look out for big honking live shows in 2024. I am talking to rocker Pete Yorn. We're probably going to have Abigail Spanberger, gubernatorial candidate in Virginia, on. So many big names coming up. Do follow at handle Full D Radio on all the socials. If you are just joining us, my guest is Adil Vaid, founder of MBA-ish. This is the phenom on Instagram, at the very least. I know you're on TikTok. You're a former management consultant, startup CEO, product leader. I called it spreadsheet monkey. Well, after I realized what I was doing, is that okay? I mean, you know.
I mean, I would like to say that I evolved from spreadsheet monkey to, VC funding chasing monkey to user experience monkey. The monkey doesn't change. It just evolves into different things. So I'm still, and now I'm a meme monkey. So we'll see how it goes. But at the end of the day, after a little while, you just realize that some of this stuff is just mundane and you got to get through it. When I started this memes journey, because of that smartphone, I was, you know, secretly writing some of this stuff down during my meetings and engaging with my followers during my meetings as a way to escape the insanity that I was dealing with at that time. But it's not entirely true. I think there are still companies who are very strict about their policies of the smartphone and, you know, you have to use their LAN network and there's certain restrictions that come with it. But the opt-out that I have seen is more around DMs. That's where people really let go and have conversations. They're like, I just came out of this brutal meeting. I just want to rant. And I'm like, go ahead, you know, share your thoughts, share your ideas. And what I'm finding is before people would like and share and comment, but now once we've built enough of an audience and they've trusted me with the voice and trusted my team with the voice, they're actually coming in and they're venting to us in our DMs, in our stories, and telling us what's going on, helping us, asking us if there's ways to navigate. Or sometimes they would just start off by saying, listen, I just want to vent here. Can I vent? And I'm like, go ahead. And what we have realized from that experience is that memes have become a doorway to therapy. That's really what memes are. We are therapists. Internally, when we talk to our teams on our Slack, we realize we entered into the space for entertainment purposes, but this has now become mass therapy of 500,000 people engaging, discussing what issues. Yeah, it makes you feel like you're not alone. The message that we keep hearing over and over again is, you have made me feel like I'm not alone, or, oh my God, thank you so much. Like, you know, the thing that we didn't realize is that how people connect to these memes at a very deep emotional level. There is something so powerful in people just saying, listen, I wake up in the morning and I'm looking forward to your meme, because we post once in the morning, once in the night. Or I come from work and I'm going through your feed or going through your stories because I want to feel connected and validated that the things that I'm feeling right now are in fact insane. And yes, they are. They are indeed insane.
You were listening to some of the recent episode MBA-ish. Catch the entire conversation wherever you get your pods. Full disclosure, special thanks to Claire Morgan and Case Graham at Noterly, Kim Zaninovich, and the University of Richmond's Robbins School of Business. If you are listening to us on the radio, note that while we often cut for broadcast link, the entirety of every interview is on podcast. The link, again, please subscribe, is fulldradio.com, fulldradio.com. And follow along on all social media at handle fulldradio. A shout out to our listeners on Radio IQ, NPR News' mega station across Virginia. Message me if you'd like to carry full disclosure on your air. My DMs are always open. And catch me every week on NPR's Here and Now. I'm Robin Farzad. Thank you for listening. Back with you next week.